For people who are struggling with their weight and struggling with food cravings, it's actually very helpful for them to even have the understanding that what they think are their own desires for foods aren't necessarily theirs, or certainly aren't all theirs. And that is quite an empowering realization.
That was Robin Shooter, and this is the Big Impact Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Chisholm. Thanks for being here. I'm so happy to have Robin back on the podcast this week. She is definitely a favorite of not just mine, but of yours as well. I get so much feedback about the episodes with her. So I brought her back on the show this week to deep dive into a topic which I know is kind of top of mind for a lot of people at the moment and is in the media a lot recently, and that is gut health. So I wanted to dispel some of the myths around gut health. I wanted to get really clear on what it means when gut health looks good, what it's supposed to look like, what's supposed to be happening in our bodies for that to be operating correctly, and what it looks like when it goes wrong. What are some of the diseases that can stem from dysbiosis or kind of an imbalance in our guts? We talk about so many different topics. We talk about, gut health, disease, breastfeeding, cesarean, antibiotics, autism. We go into so many different things. This episode does go for over an hour because once we start talking about gut health, Robin and I cannot stop. But I know you're going to love this. This really dives deep into a topic. Instead of just hearing from an expert, perhaps on the surface level of something that they're interested in or something that they're promoting at the time, I wanted to speak to Robin or someone who is really knowledgeable around this area, and she sure is that. So I hope you guys enjoy this. I'm going to put links to everything that we discuss in the show notes. And reach out and let us know what you think of this episode and if you enjoy these kind of deep dives into topics, because I'd love to get her back on, or if you have any suggestions of other people that you would like me to really get down to the nitty gritty and investigate a topic in terms of plant-based nutrition, then I would love to hear from you because I want to put out what you guys want to hear. That's always really important to me. All right, no more from me. Let's get into this conversation with myself and Robin Shooter all around gut health. Hello, Robin Shooter. Thank you so much for making your second appearance on the Big Impact Podcast. How are you today?
It's a pleasure to be back. I'm well. Yes, I'm excited by all the moving and shaking in the plant-based world.
So am I. It's every day it seems like something new is happening and exciting. And I follow this thing on Facebook, you probably do too, called Plant-Based News. And I've got it pinned to the top of my feed now, so every day I can kind of come in and look what's going on in the plant-based movement.
It's really inspiring, isn't it? It just it makes you want to get up out of bed and go and change the world.
It totally does. There's something, and I know you're kind of doing a lot of research on this, but there's something to be said about being part of a community, whether that's in real life or online. But it does. It continues to inspire me and feel like I'm part of something greater than just myself, which is pretty cool.
Totally does. And as you know, I'm doing a research project right now on the value of belonging to a Facebook group. And as it turns out, it's incredibly valuable for people to connect with like-minded people, even if it's sort of, in inverted commas, only online. They still feel supported.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So I have got you back today to talk all about gut health.
Our favorite subject.
And I guess, you know, it's been coming up in the media heaps and getting more attention, and there's buzzwords like gut health, microbiome, dysbiosis, all these things. And it's an area that I think people are interested in more and more. And what I see happening is that there's some misinformation out there. So I wanted to have you back on the podcast because I know, especially within this kind of plant-based movement, you are somewhat of an expert on this topic. And so I want to clear up some of the myths around gut health, and I want to kind of get into the juicy bits around what it means, what happens when it's out of balance, what can we do to bring it back into balance, all those kind of questions, so that we can paint for our listeners a really clear picture on this issue.
Fantastic. Let's do this.
Awesome. Okay. So let's start with a definition. What actually is the microbiome?
Let's actually back up from that a step, because there are two terms that are important to understand. People often mix them up. So the first term is microbiota, and the microbiota comprises all of the microorganisms. They're mostly bacteria, but then there are also archaea, there are viruses, there are parasites, there are eukaryotes, there are fungi. There are somewhere between 10 and 100 trillion of these organisms that inhabit the gut. It's hard to count them. I mean, you can't sort of go into the human intestine and do a head count, right? But they're somewhere in that neck of the woods. And so we know that they outnumber our human cells by at least 10 to 1, which means we're a lot more bug than human. So that's the microbiota. Now, the microbiome refers to the genetic material and the signaling molecules that are produced by all of those microorganisms. And that genetic material, again, outweighs human genetic material by around about 100 to 150 to 1. In other words, less than 1% of the genetic material of the total human organism is actually human in origin. The rest is microbial.
That is crazy to think of, isn't it?
It makes you really question what it means to be human. It looked at in volume terms, total microbial content weighs somewhere between 2 and 4 kilos, and the human brain is usually about 1.3 to 1.4 kilos. Mm-hmm. So our bugs weigh more than our brains.
That is so crazy. Mm.
And mind-blowing.
It kind of brings up that question, doesn't it, that is it our second brain or is it actually our first brain? It's like, what's your take on that? What is the significance of some of, you know, but people coming out and saying it's our second brain, what does that actually mean?
Usually among researchers, the second brain refers to the enteric nervous system. Okay, so the digestive tract has its own nervous system, and it's a very complex nervous system. It has between 50 and 100 billion nerve cells. It has receptors. They're actually taste receptors in your intestines that when we break down carbohydrates, when we digest starches and they turn into glucose, we have sweet taste receptors on the walls of our intestines that signal the digestive tract, oh, blood sugar is coming in, better send the insulin out. So it's incredibly complex. And the enteric nervous system, the second brain, and the central nervous system, the first brain, are connected by the vagus nerve, which is the 12th cranial nerve. It's a really thick nerve cable that runs between these two nervous systems. And it is extremely highly trafficked. So there's nerve signals going back and forth every second of the day and night. And what's interesting is that 90% of that traffic actually runs from the gut to the brain. Now, the enteric nervous system can run the gut all by itself. If you sever the vagus nerve, the digestive tract will still, if you put food in it, it will still digest it, and it'll secrete all the right chemicals, the right pH, the right amount of bile without any input from the central nervous system. But the brain is highly dependent on input from the gut.
Right.
So if you do sever the vagus nerve, and this used to be done to treat peptic ulcer, back in the bad old days, if a peptic ulcer, like a stomach ulcer or a duodenal ulcer, wasn't responding to treatment, then an enterprising surgeon could come along and actually snip the vagus nerve, which healed the ulcer but left the person in terrible trouble because they had all this disordered sensation that they experienced, constant abdominal symptoms.
Wow.
So as well as the vagus nerve, the enteric nervous system also communicates chemically with the central nervous system. So there are lots of neurotransmitters and hormones and so forth that, again, are released into the bloodstream by the gut and then travel back into the brain. But when you're talking about the second brain, as it refers to the actual gut microbiome, Well, and this is more a popular term among journalists than among researchers. But okay. So when journalists write about the gut microbiome being a second brain, what they're referring to is that these single-celled organisms, I mean, we're talking very simple organisms, right? They're prokaryotic. They don't even have the more complex features of our human or other mammal cells. But as a group, as a community, they actually function with something that you can only describe as intelligence. So single-celled organisms in community, they plan actions, they have means of achieving their outcomes, they influence our behavior. One of the spookiest examples of this, it's not a human example, but I think it's really fascinating. You've probably heard of toxoplasmosis, cat scratch disease. It's very dangerous to pregnant women. So toxo is caused by this little bug called Toxoplasma gondii, and it requires both rats and cats for its breeding cycle. So you can see the problem here. Rats don't like cats, and they tend to avoid them. So what happens is when this little bug infects a rat, it actually changes the rat's behavior. So instead of running away as soon as it sees a cat, it actually becomes sexually attracted to cats.
No.
So it hangs around. Of course, it gets eaten by the cat.
That's crazy.
Who doesn't feel sexually attracted to the rat at all, just sees it as dinner. And then this organism is able to complete its breeding cycle. So that's how powerfully they can affect and manipulate behavior in complex organisms, including cats. So do we have any examples of that in human behavior? Not that I'm aware of, but we know that bugs affect our behavior.
Yeah.
It's very clear from the research so far. So that's what's meant by the gut microbiome being a second brain. These organisms are highly intelligent in community.
Yeah, I that's super interesting. And I want to get into that further in relation to how it affects our behavior, because I think that will help explain, you know, the significance or the link between gut health and weight loss and cravings and all those sorts of things. But let's just kind of keep on track at the moment so we can kind of broaden our spectrum of what we know to be true about the gut. So, okay, so we know now how many kind of gut or how important it is to our body and the significance between what's happening in our brain and what's happening in our digestive system with these little guys. What would be some of the diseases or symptoms or conditions that can result from, well, first of all, tell us, what is dysbiosis in the gut? What is that buzzword mean? What does it mean when our gut's not working properly? And then maybe from there go on to what are some of the diseases or conditions that can happen when this is out of balance?
For sure, yes. The term dysbiosis gets thrown around quite a lot, and it really just means an imbalanced situation with respect to all of these microbes in the gut. So it is, in perfectly healthy, normal people, there are, you know, a certain proportion of microorganisms in their gut that are capable of causing disease. So we're all walking around right now with potentially disease-causing Clostridia or an E. coli and all sorts of things. But in a healthy person, those less beneficial or frankly pathogenic or disease-causing organisms are kept in check by the friendlies, by your lactobacilli and your bifidobacteria and the ones that we rely on for all sorts of functions in our bodies. So dysbiosis is where imbalance is created such that the ones that are disease-causing or potentially disease-causing, because there is a group of bacteria that will kind of go with whatever's happening, and there's a phenomenon known as quorum sensing. So if you think of a board of directors of a company, right, if one of the directors wants to take the company in a different direction, they have to gain a quorum, and then once they get a certain proportion of votes on their side, they can, you know, take that company right. The direction they want to. Well, bacteria do the same thing. So they're constantly sensing what's going on among the neighbours. And if a little crew of bad bacteria sense that that they're getting the upper hand, they will signal the neighbouring bacteria and say, hey, things are tipping in our favour. Do you want to join us?
Sneaky. Yeah,
absolutely. And they can actually swap genetic material with each other as well. So bacteria get together and they have gene swaps. So if bacteria have developed antibiotic resistant genes, for instance, then they can pass them on to the neighbours. And now you've got a whole tribe of antibiotic resistant bacteria. So that's what dysbiosis is. Now, when it comes to the question of what kinds of conditions is dysbiosis involved in, honestly, Anna, I would have to say, as the research on the gut microbiome unfolds, it seems like there is nothing that goes wrong in the human body that doesn't have some connection to dysbiosis. Now, it's not always clear whether the gut dysbiosis comes first or whether the gut dysbiosis is a consequence. So, for example, when you look at obesity, obese people have a very different gut microbiome than lean people. But is that a consequence of the fact that they've been eating perhaps a high-fat or high-animal protein diet for many years and that's affected the gut microbiome? Or do they become overweight because they have bad bugs? All we have at this stage are mouse experiments. And so if you take mice, they're called germ-free mice. They're bred to be, delivered by C-section, and then they're kept in a completely sterile environment so that they never develop any gut bugs. If you transplant the gut microbiota from fat mice, from obese mice, into these germ-free mice, they gain weight. If you then wipe those bacteria out and transplant the bacteria from lean mice, they lose weight. So if your obese patient is a mouse, then we know that there's a cause and effect relationship. If it's a human, then it's not quite so clear. But certainly dysbiosis is strongly involved in autoimmunity. And there's some really interesting research that came out of Finland where they have a very high rate of type 1 diabetes. And so they were monitoring these kids who were genetically at high risk of type 1 diabetes. They had a sibling perhaps who was a type 1 diabetic. And what the researchers did is they took stool samples at regular intervals and then they tracked the kids over time to see who developed type 1 diabetes and who didn't. And it turned out that the dysbiosis actually occurred in these kids before the autoimmunity showed up. So before they actually developed type 1 diabetes, because they were genetically susceptible and a certain proportion of them did, their gut bacteria profile was already changing. And this particular species called Bacteroides dorii started dominating their gut microbiome. So we've got tantalizing little glimpses that the change in the gut microbiome may be the cause of the disease.
But just to stop you there, do we know how much of that, say with these Finnish kids, do we know how much of that dysbiosis that went on before they developed the disease has to do with how they were born, like what they were actually born with or the environment they were in? Like, did they do twin studies or anything to see the difference between maybe nature or nurture sort of thing?
Not in this particular study, and I guess the way that science proceeds is very reductionist in that scientists tend to look at one little sliver at a time. And that's necessary in science so that each concept is fully understood, but it results in a lot of fragmentary knowledge, and it's often not for quite some period of time where multiple research teams have done multiple different studies that someone then kind of pulls it all together and does that kind of work where they can say, okay, what predisposed the kids to developing this was they were born by C-section, they were bottle fed and they had dairy too early or something like that. Yeah, but that's a fairly likely chain of events. So autoimmunity, there is a lot of evidence that dysbiosis plays a huge role in autoimmune diseases like inflammatory bowel disease, rheumatoid arthritis, type 1 diabetes, as I've mentioned. Then metabolic diseases, cardiovascular disease. There are bacteria that grow in the guts of people who eat animal products, and these bacteria are able to convert carnitine and choline from foods like eggs into trimethylamine oxide, TMAO, which damages arteries. And what's really interesting is that in vegans, they don't actually have these gut bacteria, so you can feed them choline or carnitine. They don't make TMAO. So that very, very interesting slant on the whole cardiovascular disease conundrum because, yeah. I mean, we know that diet plays a big role, but there are so many mechanisms by which it does, and one of those mechanisms is the effect on the gut microbiome.
So going back to autoimmune diseases, can you explain to us, first of all, like what actually happens with the autoimmune disease? What is it? What's happening in the body when someone has an autoimmune disease?
Absolutely. So in an autoimmune disease, the person's immune system is actually attacking their own body tissues. So in the case of rheumatoid arthritis, they're attacking the joint tissues. In the case of Crohn's disease, it's attacking the lining of their intestine. And the $64,000 question is, why would your immune system attack your own body? And one of the prominent theories for that is that that's actually driven by autoimmunity. Autoimmunity is actually driven by dysbiosis. So when a person eats a diet that's very low in fiber or another plant polysaccharides, for instance, so that the gut bacteria don't have what they need to eat and thrive, many of those bacteria will start actually attacking, that they'll start eating the mucus lining of the intestines. So the intestines produce a layer of mucus and it serves a couple of roles. It's a lubricating agent. It helps food move through the system. But it also provides a separation, a barrier between the immune system cells in the wall of the gut and the bacteria. Now, once those bacteria start chomping away at the mucus, they're going to come in direct contact with those immune cells. And the immune cells will then recognize them as being potential invaders, which they are in those circumstances. They might then make antibodies against those bacteria. And some of those antibodies made against bacteria will actually cross-react with human tissues. And we know that from several autoimmune diseases. So, for example, women who have had a history of urinary tract infections, they will commonly go on to develop rheumatoid arthritis. And there's a cross-reaction between antibodies against a bug called Proteus mirabilis, which causes UTI. And that, so there's a little amino acid sequence, amino acids being the components of protein. There's a little amino acid sequence in the antibody, or in this bacteria, that looks a lot like a protein sequence in our joint tissue. And so the antibody goes running around the system looking for bacteria to mop up, and instead it finds joint tissue and says, you look a lot like that bacteria that the immune system told me to, you know, latch onto and kill. And so it blows up the joint tissue instead of the bacteria.
Wow.
So this process of autoimmunity driven by dysbiosis, it is. I geek out on all this stuff. I hope your listeners aren't glazing over, but I do love the science-y part. So there's a massive effect on autoimmunity. There's also a major effect on what we might call mental health conditions like depression, anxiety. The microbiome seems to play a big role in those as well.
Wow. So with the kind of mental health stuff, and I am interested in that because I've also been hearing, you know, a lot of people ask questions around this, whether there's a significance or a relation between the two. Is that, you know, forgive my lack of science knowledge, has that got to do with what you were talking about, the connection between our actual brain and our gut, like it actually working on the chemicals in our brain? How does that, like, what's the significance of mental health disorders being related to the gut?
Absolutely. A couple of different ways that our gut microbiota or our gut microbiome affect the function of the central nervous system. These bacteria influence endocrine cells. They're called enterochromaffin cells. They're neuroendocrine cells. They're cells that line the intestine, and they produce hormones and neurotransmitters. Right. So bacteria can actually trigger the release of neurotransmitters and other compounds that are active in the brain, like serotonin, like dopamine, like GABA. And the other thing is that these bacteria actually produce those chemicals themselves. This is relatively new research, but it turns out that many of these neurotransmitters, probably all of them, such as dopamine and serotonin, that are so important to the way that our brain cells communicate with each other. They have their origins in bacteria. And so the 90% of serotonin, the neurotransmitter that's associated with mood states, and of course the most common, most often prescribed class of antidepressants now is serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, drugs like Prozac and Zoloft and so forth. 90% of our serotonin is actually in our gut, not our brain. So there are our gut bugs busily, you know, producing these chemicals, stimulating our own cells to make these chemicals, which affect both gut and brain function. And what's interesting about that is that certain bacteria are going to thrive in an environment that, say, is dominated by the types of neurotransmitters that are released when a person is highly anxious. And in order to prolong that mood state, the bacteria can actually directly affect mood, but they can also influence our food choices. So, for instance, I mean, there is just a mountain of evidence now that a high intake of fruit and vegetables is associated with better mood states, less anxiety, less depression, more feelings of creativity and connectedness. And obviously, there are certain bacteria that really get off on digesting the remnants of fruit and veg, and there are others that aren't so keen. Well, the ones that aren't so keen, that instead thrive on fats, they can manipulate behavior to cause people to eat more fat. Right. So, for example, when a person's down in the dumps and they crave chocolate, there are certain bacteria that go, wow, this is great. We love it when all that fat comes down the chute here, because that is the best environment for us to replicate in. So let's manipulate this human to eat more chocolate and eat more ice cream.
You know, it kind of poses the question or brings up the issue, which so many of my clients, and I presume your clients as well, struggle with, that they think it's all about willpower and they're not good enough because they can't possibly make good choices. You know, when you hear about this and the science behind what's actually going on, it's no wonder people make poor food choices, especially if they've been in that pattern of doing so and changed their gut microbes to actually be craving these foods.
Absolutely.
It's like we have no choice but to eat those poor foods. It's like,
yes,
makes
it's
me
not
sad
about
to think that people have, you know, little control over these things.
Yes, the only thing we can control is what we're exposed to, just in terms of our environment. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, this relationship between us and our gut microbiome is as ancient as, I mean, it goes right back. We co-evolved with these bacteria, and that co-evolution took place in a totally different environment to the one that we live in now. So back in the day, in our evolutionary past, it made sense to have gut bacteria who said, eat fat, eat fat, eat fat, because you couldn't get that stuff very often.
Yeah.
So when those bacteria influence you to get stuck into, you know, the walnuts, when the walnut tree was in season, yeah, good idea, because that's the last you're going to see of walnuts until the tree's in season again. But now we have this 24/7, 365 days a year availability of food that is totally out of whack with our evolutionary history. And our relationship with our gut bacteria is not kind of keeping pace with that. So we've still got these gut bacteria that are saying, eat fat, eat fat, eat fat.
Yeah.
But whereas that was adaptive behavior before, it's really maladaptive for us now in an environment where there's a constant availability of this kind of food.
So you said a minute ago that it, you know, the only control we do have is over our own environment, obviously, and hoping, making the right choices, I guess, with different things like food, but also other things. So what do you see as the biggest threat to our guts? What should we be looking out for in food and the environment that might be harmful to us?
The first most obvious threat to our microbiome from the environment is, of course, antibiotics. And there have been many papers and books written on this. I would highly recommend the book Missing Microbes by Martin Blaser. It is a darn scary read. You should get Martin Blaser on the podcast one
day. Microbes.
He'd be a fabulous guest.
What was his
name
again?
Microbes?
Tell me.
Yeah, it's Blaser, B-L-A-S. E-R, Martin Blazer.
Okay, I'll put that in the show notes.
It's a really read. Awesome. Yeah, please do. So Missing Microbes really tells the story of what we're doing with antibiotic overuse. And I'm not just talking about prescribed antibiotics, although they are a serious problem. Mm-hmm. And the World Health Organization has, there have been several papers issued by the WHO where they talk about a post-antibiotic age, where the antibiotics that we have just don't work anymore. Mm-hmm. And we go back to the bad old days of people dying as a consequence of surgery or dying of infections that have been easily treatable up until relatively recently. But the hidden problem with antibiotics is the antibiotics in animals. So the antibiotics that are fed to dairy cows, for instance, because they've been genetically selected to have these stupendous udders so that they can produce more than 10 times the milk that a dairy cow produced 150 years ago. And as a consequence, they get mastitis all the time, so they're given antibiotics, and the farmer is supposed to not put that milk in the milk supply, but it ends up in there. And how do we know that? Because there are antibiotic residues in milk samples that are randomly tested by, for example, university researchers. The industry doesn't regulate this. It's left to usually individual researchers who are interested in this to go to the supermarket, buy a litre of milk and see what's in it. And more often than not, there are multiple different antibiotics, usually at low levels per antibiotic, but when you've got 10 separate antibiotics all at a low level, that's a lot of antibiotics. There's antibiotics in the feed that's given every day to factory farmed animals, so pigs and chickens, and this problem, and also of course laying hens, so there are antibiotic residues in the eggs that people buy. So most people are consuming antibiotics on a daily basis. They don't realize it. They only think of antibiotics in terms of going to the doctor and getting a script for antibiotics. So that is really the major threat. And as I mentioned before, bacteria can actually transfer their antibiotic-resistant genes onto other bacteria of their own species or of totally different species.
And so just, you know, to remind us what antibiotics actually do, what do they do to the gut? They just wipe out the good and the bad and the ugly sort of thing?
They're indiscriminate killers, and doctors unfortunately tend to prescribe broad spectrum antibiotics. This is one thing that is very good for your listeners to bear in mind, that if they ever do have an infection that requires antibiotics, they should get a culture done and see which bugs are involved in the infection so that the doctor can choose a narrow spectrum antibiotic rather than a broad spectrum. 5 days on a broad spectrum antibiotic will wipe out 30% of your gut flora. And I don't know about you, but I have seen clients, both children and adults, who have been on 5, 10, 15 courses of antibiotics over a couple of years. This is particularly tragic when it happens for children, because by the age of 3, our gut microbiome is fairly well established. Well, I've seen kids who've been put on one course of antibiotics after another familiar infections, which, by the way, is totally ineffective. In fact, antibiotics increase the risk of the infection recurring in either the same year or the opposite year. So there's no benefit to the child. There's only harm that is done by this practice.
So is it lack of education amongst our GPs that lead them to be...
When doctors are surveyed, they usually cite parent demand as the reason why they prescribe antibiotics, even when they know they're not effective. So
crazy.
The parent will actually say, my kid has an infection, I want antibiotics. And if the doctor says, well, no, these won't benefit your child, you at most you might get half a day's less ear pain and that's it. And then the price for that is your child's gut microbiome is severely depleted and they're at risk of having a second infection. Many parents will still say, give me the antibiotics anyway.
And what is that, the desperation of a mother who just needs some sleep and wants her kids to be happy again?
I think that parents are very averse to having their children suffer. And so they think that anything is going to be better than nothing. And in the case of antibiotics, that's actually not true. You're better off just giving the child good nursing care and using just a very simple non-medical pain relief techniques. And just if it's a breastfed baby, you just feed them around the clock. and then they get better and they're fine. And then they have a much lower risk of getting another infection, especially if you clean up their diet, because most of these kids have a terrible diet. That's why they're getting ear infections.
Well, hopefully by, you know, releasing episodes like this and trying to educate the public on perhaps what's wrong with using antibiotics, what are the long-term effects, you know, maybe that's where our education needs to go, not whether it's effective at the time or not, because it sounds like the parents, even if it's they only know that it's got to work for half a day of pain relief or whatever, perhaps educating them about the long-term effects on this gut, you know,
Absolutely. Problem
that's going to happen is where we need to focus our attention.
And if you want to talk long-term effects, there is quite a lot of evidence that women who have used antibiotics recurrently over their life have a higher risk of breast cancer. So that's pretty serious. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not just talking about proneness to middle ear infections. We're talking about life-threatening disease here from antibiotic overuse, indiscriminate overuse. There's a time and a place for antibiotics, right? If you have bacterial meningitis, take the darn antibiotics and then take probiotics and, you know, focus on healing your gut afterward. But for things like, as I say, middle ear infections, tonsillitis, which is almost always viral, not bacterial, and certainly for colds and flu, which are always, always viral, never bacterial, antibiotics just should not be taken. Stay away from them.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, I'm glad that you did say that there is a time and a place. I mean, the biggest time I can picture myself using antibiotics, and I think I'm a relatively good sample of the people that are listening to this podcast, two times in my life. First of all, having cesareans, which unfortunately, because my kids were breech and whatever reasons, having cesareans. So then obviously after a surgery, they're giving you antibiotics. The second,
they're not always necessary, by the way.
Yeah,
prophylactic antibiotics
point.
After surgery, not always necessary. There's some new research emerging on that. So it's worth really quizzing the doctor, what is my risk of infection? Do I need to have this or not? If there's clear evidence that the benefits outweigh the risk, then go with it, right? Mm-hmm. But often there isn't clear evidence. It's just hospital practice to do this.
Mm, that's a very good point. I guess, you know, it all comes up around pregnancy or just after birth for me, because the other time I got recurrent mastitis with my kids, and I remember being in that state of, like, fevers and, you know, and I was like, please, someone just give me something to make this pain stop and so that my kid can start feeding again. But again, like you say, perhaps that's not the best method. Maybe we don't have the information, or in that vulnerable state, I know as a new mother, not having the assertiveness, perhaps is the right word, to stand up against someone who's telling you that.
I would say that mastitis of that degree is also just poor management on the part of the hospital, because usually mastitis results from, well, let me put it this way. Most cases of severe mastitis like that could be prevented by giving women access to a lactation consultant. Mm. Women in our society don't know how to breastfeed. Mm. It sounds bizarre, but we don't, because we don't see it. Whereas women in developing countries, they see other women breastfeed all the time, and so they don't have the issues with positioning and so forth that cause the nipple soreness and the mastitis that you see a lot of in Western women. So for me, that's all about the hospital or wherever else you give birth, providing appropriate information to women and hands-on, literally hands-on help with breastfeeding, so that women don't get into that state where there may be a necessity for antibiotics. I mean, I don't know about your particular situation, but when you're starting to run a fever like that, that's getting dangerous. The tragedy of it is that it went that far for you without...
Absolutely. And without, I totally infection. Agree with that. I think... Yeah, that was absolutely the issue with me. And, you know, sadly, because I got so many infections and didn't know how to do it properly, my milk started drying up and I gave up, you know. And then you get all those, I mean, it's a whole new topic, isn't it, about
it
mother
is.
Guilt.
I mean, it's sad that women are the ones left carrying the burden of guilt when actually they were just so badly let down by the system, by the healthcare providers who should have been anticipating all of this and providing the care. But that's another threat, now that you mention it, the threat to the gut microbiome is C-sections and bottle feeding. Now, once again, there is definitely a time and a place to C-sections. if you're looking at a situation where there's an obstructed labour or that baby just isn't coming out or some other emergency situation, totally. C-sections save lives, save mothers' lives, save babies' lives, no doubt about it. But I see so many cases where a woman was told that she needed a C-section when really I think if she'd got a second opinion or if she'd gone to a midwife's clinic, she may well have been able to have a vaginal delivery. And this is really important in establishing the baby's gut microbiome because, of course, when the baby comes down the birth canal, which, by the way, and this is fascinating, in the weeks leading up to giving birth, the mother's gut and her vagina prepare for birth. There's a massive increase in the number of bacteria in both the gut and the vagina, and a shift in species so that the baby will be colonized with the right kind of bacteria as it comes down through the birth canal. In particular, babies need lactic acid digesting bacteria because they're about to have breast milk and they don't have any, they're more or less sterile in the womb. There's some bacteria that sneak through. They're now finding bacteria in the placenta. They're more or less sterile though. They don't have many bacteria. So they've got to get a load of them as they come through the birth canal in order to be able to digest lactose. And so these lactic acid producing bacteria proliferate in the mother's vagina. And then, of course, the baby in a normal vaginal delivery gets, and I know this sounds gross and you probably won't look at your mum the same way ever again, but the baby comes down with its mouth open, right? And gets a good old mouthful of mum's bacteria. And then the baby latches onto the nipple and transfers the bacteria in their mouth onto the breast so that it can then keep on getting topped up with lactic acid, with lactose digesting bacteria. I know, it's mind-blowing, completely mind-blowing.
So cool. And it makes you realise, like, the significance of that. And I think, again, in today's, where we're living today, and especially this sound, I don't know if this is only my experience, but I feel a lot in the private hospitals that it's suggested that, or cesarean seems to be the easiest option. And perhaps that's, you know, I think just like with the antibiotic thing, I think if you ask a doctor, a lot would say that's because of the mother's demand or, you know, the patient's demand that they ask for it. So that it's a tricky conversation.
It is a tricky situation. Martin Blaser actually writes about this in Missing Microbes, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically says, look, if a woman wants a C-section, the doctor should present her with like a 20-page document of the consequences for her baby and then say, well, if you're happy with all of this, sign here. But often women don't understand the full ramifications of having a C-section delivery. And, of course, when it is medically necessary, and I totally get that there are many, many cases where it's medically necessary, then you can to some extent replicate a normal vaginal delivery by just basically swabbing the mother's vagina and then using those swabs to wipe the baby from head to toe and inside the mouth. Yeah. Because otherwise the baby is going to get colonized by the bacteria, for example, the streptococci that live on the skin of the birth attendants, the doctor or the midwife or the nurse, or the bacteria that are floating around in the air in the delivery suite or on the sheets or whatever have you. But if you swab that baby with mum's microbes, virtually immediately after birth, you can overcome to some extent the harms done by a C-section. Yeah. So if there's a necessity for it, write that into the birth plan that the baby will be swabbed after birth.
And I think I can speak for both of us when I say that there's absolutely no judgment on our part for women that have had a cesarean section.
Not at all.
It's just this, lack of education of what are the long-term consequences. And if we'd known some of these things and been educated around this, I think some of us may have made different decisions. But
I completely agree with that. This is not about attacking women who've had a C-section. I mean, I was a C-section baby. Yeah. So was my husband. I have good friends who planned beautiful, you know, water births, home births, all of that, and then their labour didn't go as planned and they ended up having C-sections. It happens. But I'm big on informed consent. If a person's going to undergo a procedure, whether that be a test, surgery, take a pill, whatever, they should be given proper informed consent. Like, these are the benefits of treatment, these are the risks of treatment, these are the alternatives, these are the risks and benefits of the alternatives. Now go away, make up your mind, right? No need to make the decision on the spot. Talk it over with your partner, your mum, your best friend. But so much decision making is done for the patient in a very paternalistic way. And it's done with such a sense of urgency that people feel they have no choice and they don't have time to think through their options.
Mm. It seems like there's a place for people like you and I to educate midwives and educate doctors and everyone that's kind of part of the birthing experience for women. You know,
I think midwives really get this, you know, midwives, obstetric nurses maybe not so much, but midwives really, really get this. They get that vaginal delivery and allowing the baby to breastfeed, you know, as soon as possible after birth. They get the importance of this, how significant it is, but not just in terms of the gut microbiome, but all sorts of elements of the mother-child bond and long-term health consequences.
Absolutely.
But you're right, we need to get these messages out here to healthcare providers.
Okay, let's bring it back to...
Yes, let's.
We're going to go for hours. We might need to cut this in 2 months. So going back to the threats on our gut. So we've talked about antibiotics, we talked about C-sections. Talk to me about food. What are the food threats, in inverted commas, that are going to lead potentially to dysbiosis in the gut?
Yeah. Well, two factors that usually go hand in hand, inadequate fiber and other plant polysaccharides. So fiber is the term that's commonly used, but actually it's a very mixed group of what are called polysaccharides, which just means carbohydrate molecules of various shapes and sizes. And what usually goes along with a diet that's inadequate in fiber is a diet that's too high in fat. So as I mentioned before, if we don't eat enough fiber and pectin and all these other plant polysaccharides, then our bacteria that need to digest those fibers in order to carry out their own metabolic processes, they are not going to have any choice but to turn to our mucus lining the intestinal tract as a food source. Mm. And that, as I mentioned, triggers autoimmune disease. When people aren't eating enough fiber, commonly what's happening is they're eating a lot of animal products. I mean, it is possible, I suppose, to eat a very highly processed vegan diet that is low in fiber. But again, that tends to be very high in fat. So you end up with this total shift in terms of what species of bacteria are living in your gut. And on a high-fat diet, you're going to grow a lot more bile-tolerant or bile-loving organisms. And these, what they do is they produce what are called secondary metabolites from bile. And these have a big impact on diseases like cancer and heart disease and diabetes. So the composition of the diet, first of all, whether it's high in plants or high in animal products, but also the diversity of the diet is very important. Mm. When you look at the gut microbiome of gatherer hunters, Martin Blaser's wife has actually lived among isolated tribes in the Amazon, and she's studied their gut microbiome. And these people have the most extraordinarily diverse gut microbiome because they eat seasonally, they eat what's around them, and they just have a far more diverse diet than the average Western person whose diet, I mean, look, I know you take food journals as well. I'm sure you've had clients who eat something like, you know, half a dozen foods. When you really look at it, like it might appear they're having different foods. They might have they might have cereal for breakfast and a sandwich for lunch, but it's still bread. Yeah. They might have milk on their cereal and cheese on their sandwich, but it's still dairy. Yeah. So they're drawing their diet from an incredibly narrow range of foods. And the difference in microbial diversity between people living on the typical highly processed Western diet and people living on these indigenous diets is just vast. And in any environmental setting, you can measure the health of a community by measuring its diversity. So in an ecosystem like a rainforest, it's incredibly diverse. In a crop monoculture, you know, those thousands of hectares of wheat that are grown in Australia and the US, that's a very unhealthy ecosystem, a very unbalanced one. So the lower the diversity, the worse the situation. So that's really the bottom line in terms of food. Eat more plants. Eat a high-fiber, relatively low-fat diet, and eat a range of plants. Mm. That's the way to ensure a healthy gut microbiome.
Yeah, cool. when we talk about treating some of these conditions or diseases that are caused by our gut being out of balance or kind of dysbiosis in the gut, there's some research which is coming out, which is pretty gross, about fecal transplants. And I know on the program, for those in Australia who are listening to the Insight program the other night on the SBS, all about kind of gut microbiome and this, they were talking about this. For those that might have missed it or don't understand the concept, they take the poo of someone from that has a healthy microbiome and they transplant it into somebody who doesn't. Is that right? And the idea is that all those good bacteria from someone with a healthy gut are going to just work in the same way in someone else's gut. Like, that just seems crazy to me that they would know, these gut, these microbes would know what to do in somebody else's environment to try and make them healthy.
Yeah, so fecal microbial transplant, or FMT, is a really fascinating procedure. There is, up to this point, only one condition that is proven effective in, and it is really effective, and that's C. diff, Clostridium difficile infection, which commonly occurs as a complication of antibiotic treatment. And as I mentioned before, we're all walking around right now with Clostridia in our gut, but it keeps a low profile when it's held in check by our friendly gut bugs. So FMT is astonishingly effective at resolving C. diff, and it usually only takes one transplant to do it. There has been great interest in using FMT for other conditions such as ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, and people are sort of experimenting with it for things like weight loss benefits. And there it's far less established to be beneficial. So in the case of Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, you usually require multiple transplants. And I have a client doing this presently, and it certainly did decrease her bleeding and improved her bowel movements. But the problem is, of course, that if people don't change their diet and their lifestyle, then the transplanted bacteria are not going to take. And this is what is seen in cases where FMT has been done, is that it lasts for a certain period of time, and then slowly but surely the person's microbiome edges back to its old profile, you know, its pre-FMT profile. So not only do dietary changes need to be made, but also in people where there is where there is a lot of miscommunication between the gut brain and the main brain, and that's creating a bad environment in the gut, they also need to address that. In other words, I'm talking about people who are chronically anxious and stressed, and that stress response is actually driving an unhealthy environment in their gut, which then means that the infusion of healthy bacteria from someone else's gut just isn't going to hang around in there. It's the wrong environment for those bacteria.
So let's talk a little bit more about the significance of stress, because it kind of brings up the question, like, well, you can eat as much healthy food as you like, but if a different area of your health is out of whack, then you're not necessarily going to be healthy as a whole person, sort of thing. And I know you and I both very strongly believe in like a holistic approach to health. It is about the food, very much about the food in both of our practices, but it's also about what else is going on in somebody's life. And
totally.
For those who listened to, you know, previous episodes of the podcast, they know that, you know, I worked with you really closely to kind of heal my own gut when I had IBS, and a big part of that, and as time goes on and I see other patients suffering with similar things, I can see the increased impact of the emotional health that was going on in my life at that time, and how working with you, especially using EFT, emotional freedom technique, was so valuable in actually in the healing process. So
yes,
talk more about that. We've talked a little bit about mental health and the gut, but what is it about decreasing stress that can be effective in creating that optimal environment?
Oh, 100%. Okay, so as I mentioned before, the enteric nervous system can run the gut entirely without input from the central nervous system, but when the central nervous system gets involved, it can really mess up gut function. So when a person is anxious, probably just about everyone has had the experience where they were sitting down enjoying a lovely meal, and then either the phone rang and they got bad news, or something really awful came on the TV. By the way, hint, never watch TV while you're eating. It's a super bad idea. But they might have seen something really just nerve-wracking on the news, and then they'll feel the immediate impact of that in their gut. Mm. So they pick up the telephone and hear that a good friend's had a terrible car accident and they're in hospital, and suddenly they have no interest in their delicious meal they were just eating. Their gut's turning cartwheels. They might feel nauseated. They might have to run to the bathroom because they've suddenly got diarrhea. That's the impact that the central nervous system and its whole stress reaction program has on gut function. In the case of IBS, there is a very strong what's called comorbidity. In other words, people who have IBS are also very, very likely to be suffering from anxiety and or depression. Mm. And so IBS is now seen as being a gut-brain disorder, right? There's miscommunication between the gut and the brain, which is why EFT has such a powerful effect, because EFT directly affects the central nervous system and, again, affects that whole stress reaction program. For example, one of the measurable effects of EFT is reduced cortisol levels. So cortisol is known as the hormone of chronic stress. That doesn't make it bad. Everyone produces cortisol. If you don't make it, you die. But excessively elevated cortisol really disturbs a lot of body functions, including those of the digestive tract. So an hour of tapping lowers cortisol levels by about 20-25%, which is pretty extraordinary. And so when people are using EFT, they are reducing their stress hormone output, and that results in a quieting down of all of these signals from the central nervous system to the enteric nervous system, which means that gut brain can get on with doing its job properly. Mm. Now, as I mentioned before, certain bacteria are going to thrive in the kind of environment that is created by high levels of adrenaline and cortisol and everything else. So those bacteria want you to stay stressed if you want to see it that way. But, of course, we don't want to stay stressed. And our friendly bacteria sure as heck don't want us to stay stressed, because when we're constantly stressed, it's not a nice environment for them. So the role of EFT is basically putting a tool literally in people's hands, literally at their fingertips, where they can manage day-to-day stress, but also manage trauma. There is really interesting research that I just read last night, actually, on the difference in gut microbiome in people who do have IBS versus those who don't. Irritable bowel syndrome, I'm sorry. My husband always says, don't talk in acronyms. So IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. So they looked at college students. This is in the US. So college students who did have IBS, those who didn't. And there was a subgroup of IBS patients who had very different gut microbiomes to both to the people who didn't have IBS, but they and when they interviewed these people, they found that those who'd had a history of early childhood trauma were far more likely to have very, very disordered gut microbiomes, you know, a decade or so later when they were college students, and their symptoms were more pronounced and more prolonged than those who had a more normal-looking gut microbiome. Okay, so where does EFT come into this? Well, EFT is just brain at resolving that early life trauma and essentially changing the programming, changing the brain's response to cues in the environment. You can imagine that if a person's been subjected to trauma early on, and this could be having an alcoholic parent, this could be sexual abuse, this could be neglect, this could be being beaten as a child, that child learns that the world is a very dangerous place. Mm. And so their nervous system is constantly scanning for danger. Mm. They're like Rambo, you know. he's the news chopper overhead and he's back in Vietnam, right? So his brain is saying danger, 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 danger all the time. So this is what happens in...
Yeah, in my situation, I can just to share a bit of my story, I guess I remember when this was all happening for me and I had the IBS, and we talked a lot about, you know, me being in a car accident when I was young and the ongoing stress around car trips and, you know, so when you get triggers like that for something which is unavoidable, like using a car when you're an adult and have kids, it can make a continual stress pattern in your life.
Continual activation. Mm. That's such a fabulous example. And, of course, they looked at early life trauma in this study, but people can suffer traumatic experiences at any age in life that then cause their brains to be wired in such a way that they're again constantly perceiving danger in everyday life, which means that little things like, you know, hearing a loud noise when you're just about to go to sleep, which in most of us is just annoying. Mm-hmm. In a person who's been traumatized, say they were, I don't know, say they were in a siege, and so they hear a loud noise and their brain goes gunshot. Mm-hmm. Right? And starts screwing with their digestive function.
Mm. Oh, that's so interesting. Okay, so I'm just trying to bring us back on track. So when we talk about not cures, but I guess treatment, we talked about kind of preventative measures of gut dysbiosis, but when we think about treatment, you know, there's a lot of my friends or my clients or mums in the playground that talk about jumping on the bandwagon of probiotics. And I have definitely, you know, previously, before I kind of knew all about this topic, I have done the same thing, you know, gone to your local health food store or even your chemist, got in a health class and just this generalized sort of probiotic and taken that thinking it's kind of going to be great for you. And the reaction or the conversations I've had with people, and I heard this on Insight as well the other night, is that there's actually not a great outcome with that people don't notice a significant change or benefit in their health by taking these generalized probiotics without, number one, I guess, without looking at your specific gut and what's going on with you and looking at the particular bacteria that you might need to kind of re-inoculate yourself with, or without changing your diet or your environment at the same time. So are you on the same page as me in saying that there wouldn't be that much use in people just going to the chemist and getting in a health class and taking that for months and months without looking at what their particular situation is?
Oh, 100%. And look, not to slander any particular product, but Inner Health is actually my least favourite probiotic, because the particular strain of Lactobacillus acidophilus, the NCFM strain, is known to produce biocides that actually kill off other friendly bacteria. So I probably wouldn't prescribe that really ever. So in terms of, do probiotics work? Well, as a standalone measure, no, they absolutely don't, for reasons that you just summarised there, that if a person just takes probiotics but continues with their diet that was contributing to the problem in the first place, then nothing's going to change. Most of these bacterial species in probiotics are not resident bacteria. They don't remain in the digestive tract. They don't, you know, take hold and live there. And so once the person stops taking the probiotic, then their gut microbiome is going to go back to the state that it was in before. And if they're still stressed and they're still eating a terrible diet and they still don't exercise and they still take antibiotics or they still use these antimicrobial sprays around the house and so forth, if they're still doing all the things that messed up their microbiome in the first place, then taking probiotics won't fix it. But the second thing is that the benefits of probiotics are very specific to strain and species. So there are some probiotics which will speed intestinal transit time up. So they're what you would give a person with constipation. But there are other strains and species of bacteria that will slow transit time down. So you give them to a person with diarrhea. Now, you don't want to give a particular species that speeds up intestinal transit time, in other words, the rate at which food moves through the gut, to a person with diarrhea. That's really not helpful. So the problem with the scattershot approach is that people are just buying products without understanding even what's in them, what strains, what species, what clinical testing has been done on those particular strains and species. And there is a growing evidence base for the specific benefits of specific bacterial strains and species, but we can't extrapolate from that to say probiotics are good for you, right? It's like, which probiotic for which person in which circumstance?
Yeah, right. That makes total sense. So Okay, so I think that's kind of clarified that for us. And, you know, as you've said, there's a time and a place, but you really need to be informed, perhaps a stool sample or something that shows what is going on in your particular situation is going to change the effect.
Yes, although, and I have certainly done those studies on clients in the past, but the problem with that is we're now learning that depending on what time of day the stool was passed, you'll get different results because different bacteria have a diurnal rhythm. Just like us, they have a circadian rhythm. You know, like humans have a night-day rhythm. There are some processes more active in the when it's daylight, and some that are more active when it's night. Well, so do bacteria. And so, depending on whether it's a morning poop or an afternoon poop or a nighttime poop that you send off to be analysed, you'll see different bugs in there.
Yeah, that's a good point. Gosh, it is so complex, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah. And no wonder it takes, you know, people always want a quick fix for this and that, but when you look at the complexity that we've just discussed today, it is more of a long-term treatment plan for people.
There are no quick fixes and there's no Band-Aid solution. It's a total person intervention. Yeah. That's what it takes to rehabilitate a sick gut.
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to what we kind of mentioned at the beginning and talked about how people almost have not a lack of control, but, you know, we've said how it's no wonder that people make bad food choices and kind of what the relationship is between obesity and things like that. I think a lot of buzz is coming up around weight, the connection between weight issues and obesity and gut health. For someone who is, just say someone came to you, I guess, as a client and was obese, that was one of their health concerns that they were struggling with, but they had no IBS or, you know, obvious signs of gut issues. Would working on the gut still be something that would come up during your treatment plan? Like, is this an inevitable conversation that comes up with your clients no matter their health issue, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yes, because for people who are struggling with their weight and struggling with food cravings, it's actually very helpful for them to even have the understanding that what they think of their own desires for foods aren't necessarily theirs, or certainly aren't all theirs. And that is quite an empowering realization. So when a person who really, really wants to or needs to lose weight is experiencing a craving for a cheese or chocolate or whatever their drug of choice is, for them even just to be able to say, it's not me who's crying out for that, it's my bugs. And if I am able to push through this and make a healthy choice instead, I'm going to essentially starve them down to the point where, and it usually only takes 3 or 4 days for those really intense cravings to go away. I mean, to totally remodel a person's food preferences takes longer than that. But to get them past that point of really intense food cravings, it doesn't take that long. And we see that when people with absolutely awful diets go to immersions, like you had one of my heroes, Rip Esselstyn, on the podcast. I so enjoyed that episode.
Yeah,
Rip is just
too.
Such a sweetheart in every conceivable way.
And so it's got nothing to do with his strong fireman.
Not
look,
at all.
Does
that.
It?
I just love him for his mind. His beautiful mind. So I mean, he's taking people who are just no doubt on horrendously unhealthy diets, so they wouldn't be in the shape that they're in. And within a couple of days, they're loving the food. You know, their cravings are abating. So we know that this can be done. People just need a supportive environment. And if they can't find that at home, it is good to go to a retreat to get over those cravings, to get through the worst of it in the first couple of days. And then they can start to realize, oh, I don't have to go for that food every time I crave it. I'm not saying it's easy. It's a complex issue. It's also something I use EFT for a lot, is food cravings. But getting back to your question, does the discussion of the gut come up? Yes, because I explain to people, people who are overweight, you now have an altered gut microbiome, altered in several ways. It's altered in that it's signaling you to eat high-fat, low-nutrient foods, because that's what your dominant bacteria crave. Altered in that those bacteria actually harvest more energy from the food that we eat. That's one of the mechanisms by which the gut microbiome is related to obesity. With these changes in gut bacteria, overweight people are actually extracting more calories, more kilojoules, out of the food that they eat than lean people. Okay. And once again, if you want to change that, if you want to stop that from happening, they've got to change the food so that they get different microbial populations down there.
So it's almost like there's going to be this period of discomfort.
Yes.
But once you get over that hump, then it's almost gets the ball rolling and it kind of snowballs in
That's
a positive way from there.
I think when people understand that the period of, severe discomfort is going to be finite, that helps them. Now, I was just listening to your podcast with Adam Sudd the other day too.
It just reminded me of that too.
Yes. So, you know, he deliberately put himself in situations of discomfort every day, and I'm a fan of that. I mean, we need to get over our wussiness as a, as a species. And learn that, you know, feeling hungry for a couple of minutes, it's not life-threatening, you know, you can handle it. Feeling a bit of discomfort when you commence exercising, having been sedentary for a while, you'll be okay. No, honestly, you'll be okay.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think, you know, the more and more we talk about these issues, the more people are educated in the fact that, yeah, once you do get past that, there are all these long-term effects and you'll actually change, you can actually change an influence.
And you'll enjoy the new food, you won't miss the old food. In fact, this is the other interesting thing, your gut microbiota actually change your taste preferences, the way things smell and taste to you. You've seen this in your clients, you're sure, I'm sure I see it all the time, where people will say, I had been off, you know, meat, cheese, whatever, for a couple of weeks or months, and then I went to someone's barbecue and I had a bite of steak and it was disgusting. Yeah. Or I had, you know, Grandma Nellie's cheesecake and I've always loved it in the past, but actually it made me heave.
Yeah.
So people's taste preferences really do change. They change much more rapidly than we think. And a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of that has to do with our gut microbiome.
Yeah. And I influencing guess in the same patients. Way as that, when you say people, when they go back to eating things, I know even with myself, just say I go and have a raw dessert, you know, a raw vegan dessert that there's used lots of coconut oil, some of my IBS symptoms come back. So, and it reminds you, I always find it kind of good in a way when people have these experiences because it reminds you, oh, this is why I'm making those other choices,
exactly.
You know? I won't go for that. Even though it looks great, I know what the outcome of that is going to be.
It's that 5 seconds of pleasure while you eat it and then, you know, hours, days of discomfort. Right through to agony as that fat wends its way through your system. And fat, by the way, is such a strong trigger of IBS. It triggers the gastrocolic reflex, which just means that when you stick food in your stomach, your intestines contract. But if you put fat in your stomach, they contract a lot more strongly. And by the way, just because you were talking before about, you know, popular ideas about fixing gut health, and there's this very popular notion that people need fats to fix their gut, and nothing could be further from the truth. Mm. When scientists want to induce leaky gut in lab animals, they feed them a high-fat diet. Particularly a high saturated fat diet will do it in, you know, seconds flat, basically. And so all this promotion of coconut oil for gut health is so far off base, it makes me tear my hair out in frustration that such nonsense concepts with no grounding in science can get such traction in people.
Yeah.
Mostly through the echo chamber that's created by blogs and YouTube channels and people who don't know anything that set themselves up as experts and influence all these poor suckers who just want to get well.
Well, I'm glad I have someone like you who has just spent an hour and 10 minutes of your valuable time coming on the show and actually debunking some of those myths and putting useful, informative education out there. So I cannot thank you enough. I think we've nailed it. I think we've covered every inch of it. Actually, we probably haven't because it's so complex. But thank you. I really appreciate it. And I know that I am going to be asking you back on this podcast to talk about my next juicy topic, whatever that might be in a few months. Thanks, Robin.
Look, it's always a pleasure talking to you. I love this subject. I know you do. We could probably go on for the next 6 hours, but let's give everyone a break.
Okay, let's do it. Awesome. Have a great day. I'll speak to you soon.
You too, Anna.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. I learned so much, as always, from my conversation with Robin. I hope we cleared a few things up for you and amplified your knowledge on gut health and what it means to have a healthy gut and what are some of the practical steps you can take to ensure that you have a healthy gut too and to start to heal your gut if you do have some troubles. I will put all the links we talked about and how to contact, get in touch with Robin in the show notes over at www.annachisholm.com. And over in the show notes, you'll also find that download I was talking about at the beginning of the episode, the ebook or the resource on how to create your own kombucha at home, that natural prebiotic fermented tea. So go over, grab that download, check out Robin, connect with her. She'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you thought of the podcast, and we will see you back here again next week for another episode. Bye.